Hey, Dr. B.
Hey, Luke. How are things moving in your world today?
You know, they're a little crazy. I've been thinking lately, like, I think I've forgotten how to rest or how to relax. I just can't ever stop thinking about all of the work that I have to get done.
Oh, I so hear you. I feel like so many times we can get caught in this loop of constantly doing can make such a big difference in our capacity to just slow down and enjoy the moment. It's just, frankly, really stressful. Why don't we talk about that a little more?
We all get busy and stressed, but we don't have to live that way. If you don't know how to slow down and catch your breath, maybe you just need to talk to somebody. Check out Modern Therapy, a psychology practice here in Houston driven by one overarching mission: to cultivate a well-lived existence despite life's inherent challenges. Check out mymoderntherapy.com to make an appointment with Dr. Beatrice Craven or one of her associates. Again, that's mymoderntherapy.com.
Before we begin this episode, a couple of short disclaimers. Most importantly, if you've experienced domestic abuse in any form, there may be details in the following story that trigger painful memories for you. There are resources linked in the show notes for this episode that may be a help. Secondly, if you've got kids nearby, if you're at work, or if you simply offend easily, there isn't much, but there is some adult language near the end of this episode. That being said, this is an important and beautiful story, so I hope you'll listen anyway. From Milieu Media Group, this is The H, a podcast about the people and places that make Houston, Houston. I'm your host, Luke Bronner, and this is Season 3, Episode 6, Visible Hands, with B. Nguyen. In January of 2005, I stopped for gas at a Diamond Shamrock gas station in the most unfortunately named Fort Worth suburb of White Settlement. I remember it clearly for one reason. The man standing in front of me in line at the register had a distinct look. He was pretty tall with an above-average build and a handlebar mustache. His head was shaved, but beneath his camouflage hunting hat, I could see that he wasn't bald. Rather, he had a mohawk. His sleeveless t-shirt and cargo shorts were ratty and wrinkled and didn't look like they'd been washed or folded the last few times he'd worn them. He just looked kind of rough, so I was surprised when he walked out of the store and climbed into a big brand new Hummer. This was at a time before Hummers had become the standard for soccer moms everywhere. They were still a fairly new symbol of luxury and machismo. That alone wasn't enough to cement that particular fill-up in my memory, though. The reason I remember it so vividly is because the very next night I saw that same man again, when a friend and I got together at the duplex where I live to watch, for our very first time, the Ultimate Fighting Championship. Specifically, we were watching a DVD of UFC 43 Meltdown, which had taken place a couple of years earlier. I was shocked when the main event started and the guy from the gas station entered the octagon to face MMA legend Randy the Natural Couture. The fighter, Chuck the Iceman Liddell. Now, I was and remain a pacifist. Nevertheless, that night, to my surprise, I fell in love with mixed martial arts. I began ordering every pay-per-view, studying the techniques of the various fighting styles, idolizing MMA fighters with Chuck and Randy at the very top of my list. I followed the sport closely for several years before eventually canceling my cable subscription altogether to prevent myself from spending any more money on pay-per-view events. I'm out of the loop now and have been for several years as to who's who in mixed martial arts. But I still genuinely love the sport. So I was especially excited when the opportunity presented itself in early 2019 to sit down with local fighter B. Nguyen.
My name is B. Nguyen, and I'm a professional MMA fighter.
B has called Houston home for nearly 15 years, but she's not a Houston native.
I was born in Vietnam. Then we trekked over to the Bay Area, San Francisco. We came over in 1995 as Vietnamese refugees. It was a prolonged process for us, but we all came in over at the same time from Vietnam to San Francisco.
The we she's referring to is her, her parents, and her eight older siblings, six sisters and two brothers. B was only 6 or 7 years old at the time, but remembers the move pretty clearly.
I remember almost everything. And then more memories keep coming back to me as I get older too, which is promising because I get hit in the head for a living. So one memory that sticks out to me was we were at the airport leaving and I have no idea what's going on. I mean, obviously they say you're going to America, we're pursuing the American dream, everybody's happy, everybody's elated. So it was a positive thing. I remember my best friend growing up he wanted my favorite stuffed animal lion. And I was like, no, like, this is mine. What are you talking about? Can I have it? And he kept begging for it. And I was like, no, get off my back, dude. Like, I'm not giving you my lion. And then I get to America and there's like 50,000 lions at every Walmart. So I felt so bad. I didn't know the abundance that was awaiting.
She had no concept of the abundance the states had to offer because her family, even while they were in Vietnam, was very poor. Her father was a soldier in the South Vietnamese Army, and her mother did whatever she could to make ends meet.
For what I remember most of my life in Vietnam, I remember my dad being home, but when I was younger, all of my sisters tell me my dad's always been away with the war, and my dad was in a concentration camp, and then when he left the concentration camp, he was living in the mountains for a while too, so my dad was always away for unknown reasons. Even in America, it was always like a mysterious time when dad was gone, but my mom did whatever she could to make money. When we were in the village, she would sell salt. I'm sure she sold anything, food, anything like that. I was far too young to know exactly what she was selling, but she would just make money. My sister would work too. And, you know, you just sell whatever resources you have around.
One of the main sources of the family's income in those days was the small plot of land on which they lived. It also became one of the means by which Bee's tough and fearless personality was shaped.
So we had a farm, and we had boars, which, if people don't know, they're freaking dangerous. Like, they will, like, eat you. And we had chickens, and I used to go out there. I was a menace. I'd steal their egg, which is like, when you're a kid, you don't think about it. Now it's like, it's their child, right? So I steal their egg, and I'm like, na 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 na, like, in front of the hens. And I would come in the house with bloody hands just because they were, like, pecking at me. I just was always pushing the envelope. That's just always been my personality. And I was also a crazy tomboy. Like, I would climb the top of the tree and just, like, Tarzan yell and jump off. Like, it was the craziest. I know. My parents, God bless them, I don't know how they did it, but I was crazy.
Bee's family eventually made their way from Vietnam to California. And although her oldest sister had already made the move and was able to pave the way to some degree, the transition wasn't easy for Bee or her family, none of whom spoke English when they immigrated to the U.S.
She was already established here, and then she helped bring us over. Transition was, for me, it was just another city I was in. As long as I had my family, I never really worried about where we were. I was the youngest, so I was quite sheltered. But culturally, oh man, Asian culture and American culture is so different. And it was very hard for me because I was very young. So I was very impressionable. So I'm basically American, you know. I have a lot of deep roots, but I was here so early. When I go to school, people talked about, you know, things that I never thought you could talk about, or things that didn't matter in our culture. You know, I'm from a village. They would talk about their feelings. They would talk about anything and everything. And when I went home and I started to talk about it, it was just like, what do you mean? Like, finish your homework and go to sleep, you know? So the culture shock was huge. We were all tough love. And then when I went to school, everybody was so sweet and so open and had so many feelings. I think that's what I remembered. It was hard for me because I never fit in at school, but I didn't really fit in at home either because I was the American kid in the family, you know. Any complaints I had, obviously, my sisters had gone through worse. My parents was not here for it. Like, you know, they didn't acknowledge it because it was very small problems compared to what they had to deal with, you know. But when you're a kid, you don't think about those things. You're just like, nobody cares about how I feel. But that was the hard part for me. It wasn't being in America. It was home and school for me was tough. So I learned English really quickly. The house that we rented when we first got here, I remember finding two things, the Curly Sue movie and the Toni Braxton CD. I joke with my friends all the time that that's probably why I'm dramatic. If you know me, I'm super dramatic because I learned English with the Toni Braxton CD. I learned English the fastest. It's quite amazing. My older sisters, like the oldest three, they were in college teaching like advanced calculus in exchange for ESL classes. And they graduated from Dean's List, like without knowing any English. Pretty brilliant.
When they first arrived in the States, Bee and her family moved in briefly with her oldest sister, but soon found a place in San Jose to call home.
It was a small house, typical one-story, three-bedroom family home. It was all of us in there, yeah. But it was a mansion. compared to the little village house we had, or the apartment we had in Saigon was a one-bedroom apartment with 10 of us. So this house in San Jose was perfect. It was amazing. It had a backyard. I mean, it was just great.
One of the more formative experiences in Bee's new American life was the opportunity she received early on to study ballet.
I honestly don't know who came up with the money. Is it either my mom or my sister? But I got to go to ballet classes for a couple of years, and I was the only poor kid in ballet class. Like, every picture, I'm, like, on the side. But I loved ballet. I've always been a dancer, always been a artist, I think, in every kind of way with my body. I'm very expressive with my body. I danced, I played sports. I was a tomboy. I always wore baggy pants. Until my oldest sister, who basically raised me, she went away to college, and then I didn't realize until I got older that's when I spiraled. Like, I was so bad out of nowhere. Like, when all my sisters went to college and were so close in age that when it was just all of a sudden one day, all four of them were gone to college, you know? And then now I'm left with my parents, who are like, they're just providers. They're not like my friends. Like, you know, this is a huge family. So my sisters all left, and I was like, all right, well, here we are. So I started spiraling. I don't know, maybe I thought they would come back from college if I was so bad enough. I don't know why I was so bad, but I started fighting. I started skipping school, and I fought a lot just because I had aggression, and we grew up in aggressive neighborhoods, you know? So I fought a lot because me and my dad would argue a lot, and I would go to school, and all my aggression, I would just take it on the kids, you know? I was relentless. I was like that person that you never want to fight. You know, because it just wouldn't stop. Like, even the kids that thought they were the toughest, eventually people stopped fighting me. Because they just realized, like, okay, that's enough. B is, like, a psycho. Like, she's never going to stop fighting. But like I said, I was crazy from when I was young. I was brave. I never cared. Like, if you say something's hot, I'm going to touch it first. So that was always me. I was really bad in middle school. Oh, my God, my mom.
Even in the midst of fighting and skipping classes, school presented very little challenge for Bee. When she did show up, even if she hadn't done any of the requisite work, she could pass tests easily. She was far more interested in spending her time pursuing creative endeavors.
I had older friends from dancing, like hip-hop class and stuff, so I would go to, like, the junior college and, like, have dance auditions and dance competitions and stuff like that. I always wanted extracurricular activities. Like, I wanted to be more expressive. And I just could never do it because our parents couldn't afford it. So I just always snuck away to do it. I sang, I danced. We did like stepping in my neighborhood. We had step crew. I was never able to do it because I would fight and get suspended. And there was like a no list. So what I would do is I remember me and Ariana, my friend, would show up to these practices. Like all these flag team, the dance team. I would just sit there in the auditorium learning all their moves. So I knew, like, if they ever needed an alternate, even though I was on the no list, I could have jumped in at any point.
Unfortunately, she stayed in trouble at school, and the tension at home with her father didn't improve either. So early on in her high school career, Bee took matters into her own hands.
So at 15, I ran away from home. I had a friend in Texas, and I came to Texas. I still went to school, though. I forged papers for me to finish, to go to high school and finish it. But yeah, I ran away from Cali and brought myself all the way to Texas.
She came to Texas because she'd met a friend on MySpace who invited her to come and visit. So one day, after a particularly rough argument with her dad, without telling anyone, Bee bought a bus ticket and headed southeast. At the time, she had no plans to stay long term, but she also didn't have any specific plans to return to her family. Perhaps the most significant factor in Bee's running away, more than problems at school or conflict at home, was a deep need to work through her own identity.
I think that whenever I started rebelling to try to get my sisters to come home, I think somewhere along those lines, I lost myself and then I just became a kid. Once you get dubbed something, I think subconsciously you just become that person. The more you tell your kid, like, my kid's bad. Like, you know, parents say it all the time. Once you give them that title, they become that person. So in high school, I just felt bad for my mom. I was just like, I'm bad. Like, you know, I need to just venture out and find who I am, and I feel bad for her. And at the time, I didn't realize that missing me would hurt her more than me being around being bad, but I left to find myself and find who I was. I didn't know if I was American, didn't know if I was Vietnamese, didn't know if I was my sister's sister or my parents' daughter, you know, I didn't know. So I just left, and went to Texas. And it was a rough time because, you know, a young 15-year-old, impressionable. I was tough, but, you know, when you're a kid, you think you know more than you know. So I ran through, like, a lot of life lessons in the first 2 years being in Texas. Getting screwed over, meeting the wrong friends, getting taken advantage of, moving here, moving there, moving in with the wrong people. And then eventually I got an apartment. At 17 in Texas, you can get an apartment. So the good thing about me was that I was always hardworking, so I made it work. But it was tough. I knew I needed money, but I took it upon myself to enroll myself in school. So I would wake up at 6 a.m., go to school, get out at like 2 p.m. I remember one time I would go with my older friends to the bars because I knew that I didn't have an ID, but if I could get into the bars, I could talk myself into getting a job. That's how savvy I was as a 15-year-old. So I went to this bar. It was like just some regular beer bar. And I got in. So I knew once you're in, he thinks, you know, you're of age, whatever. I talked to the owner, impressed him with how smart I was, whatever. And I got the job. So I would go to school 6 a.m. to 2 p.m. I would go to work 6 p.m. to 4 a.m. because bar closes at 2, you still have to clean up. So I would sleep about 3 hours every day just to go to school. I really wanted to go to school. I wanted to really accomplish things before I went home. So I wanted my diploma.
Her desire to accomplish things before reconnecting with her family dragged out for much longer than she'd expected. It would be 9 years before she really reopened the lines of communication with them, and another year still before she'd go back to see them. She continued working at the bar, and after a couple of years in Houston, graduated from high school. But even still, her struggles were far from over.
I met this guy. Oh, man. Oh, it's a tough time. I met this guy and fell in love. It was like, so my living situation wasn't too good because my girlfriend, I lived with her and her mom, but their relationship was toxic. So when I met this guy at the bar I was working at, I fell in love with him, moved in with him, got 2 jobs, worked, had like what I thought was a little family, you know, had our car, our apartment, everything. And then he started abusing me, like really bad. I became isolated, but it wasn't too hard to isolate me, right? I was already gone from my family. And the abuse was so bad for about 4 years. He like landed me in the hospital almost every month. And like almost every time I would have to run out of the hospital because I just didn't have insurance. And I like did not want him to get in trouble. And I didn't want my parents to be contacted. It was me ending up in the emergency room. They would fix me and I'd run out. I remember doing that like at least 8 times. And then finally, we got into a car accident and he went to jail for the car accident. And then the officer saw me and was like, this is very odd. She has like cuts and bruises all over her. I had like a scar on my neck, like slit for like 3 inches across my neck. I had like bruises all over. Anyways, he asked me about my situation. He was like, who is that? Like, what are you doing here with these guys? Like, you know? And I told him the story. I told him a little bit of it. And this guy looked at me and he was like, this is the worst domestic abuse case I've worked on or I've heard of in my 25 years of working. So he went to jail. He's still in prison now. And so I was free again, but then I had to start over again. You know? Here I am, 19. No money because the apartment was in his name. After everything, I just, like, had nothing. I was just standing there. Like, they took me to the hospital to treat me. But then when I came out of the hospital, I was just standing there with nothing. And I was like, okay, are you going to finally call mom and dad? Or what are you going to do? So stubborn me said, all right, this is what you're going to do. You're going to take your bag. You're going to take the little bit of money you have. You're going to go to a motel. You're going to find a job just like you did when you're 15. So I did that, lived in a motel next to the bar that I bartended at, and saved enough money for an apartment. And then life just continued. I tell people all the time, it's like I've lived a lot of lives and I don't really know what to identify with. So I just picked one word and I think I just identify with being resilient. And that's really empowering because knowing that you are unbreakable is quite empowering, you know? And people, when they hear my story, they're like, oh, I'm so sorry it happened. I'm like, but don't be, because I know something you don't. You don't know if you'll make it past the next thing, but I will. So that's what I take out of it. I'm fine. I'm healthy. I'm successful, you know, and I'm brave now because of it. So it's all good.
So you seem like you've worked through some of the trauma that you've experienced.
Yeah.
How have you done that? Like, what's been your, if you don't mind me asking, like, how have you worked through that trauma?
I think bravely, one step at a time. I think that a lot of the things I've gone through is because I was almost too daring and I put myself in that position. But then again, I got to utilize a little self-compassion and not fault my daringness for everything I've been through. Instead, I'm going to say I've healed because I was brave. Even after that guy beat me and he went to jail, I dated. I went out to Dave & Buster's by myself because I had no friends. I went out to Dave & Buster's by myself after work or like on the weekends, and I would just hang out, smile, laugh, talk to people. Like, hello world, I'm going to hide my tears for now and just like try to make it, you know? And then guys started telling me I'm pretty, and these are way better guys. These are like guys coming from good families. These are like guys with good jobs. So it boosted my confidence. That helped me heal my insecurities, you know? And there were things along the way that there will always be things, I think, for the rest of my life that I will have to heal. But I think the key to letting yourself heal is exposing yourself. If I hid my wounds, I would never be able to lick them. So I never hid myself from the world. When I dated a guy, I told him, hey, I have nightmares. You know, this guy used to beat me. I never tried to be somebody else to get anybody to like me. And I wasn't scared to show him how many times I've been broken. And I think that bravery, I think that confidence is what helped me heal myself. I think that I still need a lot of help. Maybe I talk to a psychologist now just to make myself better. But I've healed myself because I've allowed myself to be full of cuts and scars. I've exposed myself to the world to let the world help me lick my wounds. And honestly, I'm stunned at myself. Not that I'm patting my own back or anything. It's just like I just never felt like I was a victim.
About 2 years into restarting her life yet again, when she was 21 years old, B stumbled across something that would eventually play a part in her continued healing. Muay Thai.
So I was joking one day, and I was talking to my girlfriend, Jade, and I was like, did you know people get paid to fight? Like, I didn't even know that. Girls are, like, fighting and getting paid for it. She was like, yeah, but, like, these people, like, have black belts in karate or whatever, girl. And I'm like, no. You should have seen me in high school. So I went to go take the class. I was that typical douchebag that was like, I walked into the gym and I was like, I want to fight. And the lady was like, okay, let's just take a cardio class first, kid. You know? And it humbled me. And I took that class and I was really, really good, really talented. And they were like, let's train to fight. I'm like, yeah, whatever. As long as you like don't charge me too much because I'm kind of a broke kid out here, you know? But I guess they saw enough talent in me to waive the fight training fees. Anyways, they trained me for free 4 months later, fought, destroyed this girl that had way more experience than me just with grit and heart, per use in my life, right? And then I realized I'm pretty damn good at this. You look at the UFC champions, a lot of UFC fighters have been training karate since they were little, training whatever. They had a lot of background. They had a sport to instill confidence in them. They had parents to encourage them. And here I am with none of that background, just like a handful of confidence, another hand of just homemade grit that I've, you know, made myself. And I was killing these chicks. So I realized this is what I meant to do. Like everything that I used to get in trouble for, I had to control that chaos. You know what I mean? And deliver it in such a beautiful way.
While fighting was a factor in her healing from the trauma she'd survived, the abuse she'd experienced, to my surprise, wasn't a factor in motivating her to fight.
With him, I felt like a zombie. With him, I felt numb. So even after him, I didn't feel anger like I did when I was young with my dad. I think I felt angry with my dad because I loved my dad, you know? I tell people all the time, like, you think about your exes or your issues, you're only angry because you care. I didn't care about that guy enough to be fighting for him, be fighting because of him. I didn't care enough. I was numb. He was something to do. He manipulated me. I was a zombie. It's something that happened. When I was little, I was fighting because I loved my dad. God, I adored my dad, but I was just so mad, you know? So no, he didn't give me any aggression, any revenge motivation to fight. I think I was born a fighter. I think that I have the gift of turning something that people might see as crazy, ugly, chaotic into something beautiful and deliver it in a way that people would yearn for it, like people want it. I realized that's like my gift. Even now, talking about a ex-boyfriend who cut me, punched me, kicked me, choked me, all that ugly that people don't really want to talk about, when I say it, and I can say it in a room full of blue collars, they somehow see the beauty in it, you know? And I think that's been my gift. So I think that I took the aggression and the violence that is fighting, and I think that I enjoy turning it into an art, to something beautiful.
The first few years of Bee's career were fighting Muay Thai specifically, and she had an impressive 15-2 record as an amateur.
I loved Muay Thai. I loved the art of it. I loved being a part of something. I was alone all my life, you know? So like Muay Thai has this like cool tradition with the prayers, and you got to go to a monk to get blessed for the fight. You got to follow these rules, and you got to be a part of this crew. It made me feel like a part of a family and a part of like some kind of tradition, right? So I loved Muay Thai. Fought for a while. But then MMA fighters started when Ronda Rousey and Misha Tate had their fight. These chicks were getting paid six figures. What? So I was like, if I'm going to fight for a living, I need to do MMA. Then I had to try MMA as an amateur again. So I basically had a double amateur career. And then I recently turned pro.
Although she didn't begin competing in MMA till 2015, she began training MMA a year or two earlier while still actively competing in Muay Thai.
I didn't want to do MMA until I was truly ready, but then again, I found more talent. I just caught on. I told you I've been creative with my body. I've always been artistic with my body. So I see how somebody moves and I see why. My coaches call me a conceptual learner. Like instead of telling me doing a jab cross, you tell me get close to them and use your short range. Because it makes more sense to me. I understand my body. But yeah, even when I transitioned MMA, it was a good transition, smooth.
How did the training change?
Harder. It was harder on the body. MMA is the toughest thing I've ever done on my body. Having to learn five different arts, you know, conditioning 25 different parts of your body instead of 5, 8, you know, it's hard. Then it's a mental overload. If you've ever worked out really hard, do you think you could take a test right after? It's really hard. And that's basically what MMA is. You have to understand their body, your situation. Mine has to be awake. Then you have to worry about standing up, wrestling, getting to the ground, cage. And then as the sport evolves, you got to worry about more. It's just a lot, mentally and physically. And then the weight cut. I never cut weight as Muay Thai. I was like, I cut weight like, okay, I'm not going to eat fried chicken anymore. But I fought like all the way up to 125s in Muay Thai. But in MMA, I started cutting.
Weight cutting is a brutal process fighters put themselves through in the days leading up to a fight, in which after a long season of prepping for the fight, they essentially dehydrate their bodies any way they possibly can in order to be at the appropriate weight for their weight class prior to the fight. Bee fights as an atom weight, a weight class that didn't even exist in the years I was following the sport closely, wherein each fighter's max weight is 105 pounds. The training came really naturally for Bee, just as it had in Muay Thai. But that doesn't mean the path to her pro career came easily. It didn't.
So this is what they call the process in MMA, in any sport. Things change all the time, different stages all the time. So the stage before I got to MMA was full grit, the stage of excitement, eagerness, and like no fear, right? Then you get to MMA. And now I'm peering into, like, I'm close to turning pro. Then I start getting in my head. Now I'm like, I can't turn pro until I'm good enough. Then you add in, I was popular since my first amateur fight. I don't know what it is about me that people just took to. But I had fans from my amateur career. That pressure, it was rough. I think my transition from amateur MMA to pro was really rough. I was so hard on myself. I just didn't know when to turn pro because I didn't want to fail anyone. Once again, like I just wanted to perform and do well. It took a long time. It took me switching multiple coaches to turn pro. And then I finally turned pro. in 2017, the end of 17, I think.
With a particular promotion? Or
most of my amateur, I fought for Mick Maynard for Legacy FC, locally here, and he is now the matchmaker for the UFC. I fought for his very last Legacy fight before he sold it, and I made my pro debut on TV with him, and that was really, really gratifying just because he had seen me grow as an amateur. And then I finally made my pro debut with him, and I won, so that was a good day.
Her opponent in that bout was a fighter named Andy Nguyen.
We were acquaintances, you could say friends, until then, but there weren't that many atomweights, so you kind of have to fight your friends, you kind of have to fight your acquaintances. And the interesting thing is, Andy is the very first ever professional female Vietnamese fighter, and I'm the second.
At some point along the way, leading up to her transition into professional mixed martial arts, a decade after running away as a teenager, B finally began reconnecting with her family.
The reunion with my family has been so rough for me, and I'm actually really happy. This is the most in-depth, even more so than the ESPN women's interview. This is more in-depth than I've ever been in an interview, and just so happens right now you're talking to me at a very good place in my life. Good with my family, good with my career, good with myself. But it's not been easy. The last couple of years with my family, it's been so much of miscommunication and resentment, you know? I was a stranger. They all treated me like a bad little kid that left, and I'm sure they have a lot of resentment, rightfully so, that I left for so long. I don't know what mess I left behind, you know? And then also the frustration of me telling them, like, you don't know who I am, what I've been through. Like, give me some damn respect. You know, it's just been a back and forth battle, and more so an internal battle with me. But I think I'm at a good place now where my sisters support me. At first they were like, why do you fight? In an Asian family, more so a hustler family like mine, it's like, girl, it makes no money. Honey, okay, you make no money. That's the thing. They're all successful, they're all brilliant. But they were just worried. Like, you don't make money and you hurt yourself. Avi, you know? Even us as fight fans know, like, we even talk to ourselves, like, why do we do this, you know? It's what a sacrifice. So it was rough for them. But the thing that I realized is the more you're confident and sure of yourself, you will demand respect. So over the years, my sisters are like, you know what? This girl is highly respected by her peers. She's really good at what she does, and she's very passionate, and she's not backing down. So if you can't break her down from it, join her, you know, like, support her, because they love me. So now they support me.
Have they seen you fight?
They've seen me fight a couple of times. And my sister's a gangster, you know. They're not saying don't fight, it hurts, because they're not scared to watch it. They're not scared to slap the hell out of me if I do them wrong either, you know. They're tough chicks, so they like it. They're screaming. Half of my videos, my sisters are like psychopaths, screaming. But my sisters have been great. Even my dad came to one of my fights, and I'm so happy he did, and I won that night. So I'm glad I had that moment with him, you know?
That moment became even more significant in February of 2018, when her dad, with whom she'd had a lifelong complicated relationship, died of liver cancer.
So when my dad passed, no one in the family has a relationship with my dad. I don't know if anybody in the world has a relationship with my dad. I don't know if my dad has a relationship with himself. He was so broken down by the war, and he's been isolated so long with the war, that I think that my dad was trapped in his own body, and he never knew how to express love. He didn't know how to express anything, you know, except discipline. When he passed away, I had zero relationship with him. And if I did have any, it was a lot of resentment. But then we found his diary. I still have yet to be brave enough to read it, just because I don't think I can handle the guilt yet. But my sister read it, and she told me that 80% of the diary was about me, was conversations to me. And it was like Thanksgiving 2012, no B again. 2015, I wonder where she is. No call from B. Christmas 2016. But then I realized, the more I think about it, that I am exactly the same person he is. He was a dreamer, and he was, like, brave, and he was selfless, but he didn't know how to communicate love. I was like that for a little while. But my sister found that diary, I realized he was my number one fan. Your parents are your parents. They love you. But they are their own humans also. You know, he wasn't just my dad that didn't give me what I thought I deserved. He was Frank. He was Van Yu Nguyen. That's his name. And he lost a lot in the war. So he had so much to deal with, and he was brilliant, and here he is in America not knowing how to fulfill his own life. So as I've been waiting all my life for an apology, he was waiting all his life for a thank you, I love you, and a hug too. You know, he had needs like mine, and that's what I realized when he passed away. But it's crazy because he died after. I was one of the last to visit him. He couldn't talk. He was like moaning, super skinny. But I was the last to visit him because I couldn't work up the nerve to go. And finally I went and I stood by his bed and rubbed his hands, stuff like that. I left and he died. So everybody was like, I think he was waiting for you, B.
A few months before he passed away, due in large part to the success she was having in her fight career, B was contacted by a casting director from CBS with an invitation to audition for a well-known reality TV show.
First, they offered a dating show, which I was interested in a little bit, and then I turned it down eventually because I was an athlete. It wasn't conducive to my image. And then they told me, do you know the game Survivor? I'm like, well, yeah, everybody's heard of it, but I've never watched it, right? So they told me to go watch, and I was like, holy crap, why have I not watched this game? This is so awesome. Like, everything is crazy. It's like the most competitive reality show I've ever seen in my life. So I told her yes, and then we went through final castings. And then this was... after I saw my dad, I went home. The next day, I got a call. My sister's telling me my dad just passed. And then on the other line, I get a call from Survivor saying I made final castings. So it was like, I'm trying to hold my tears back. And I just sat there and I was like, what would dad do? He would say yes. So I said yes to Survivor, got off the phone, and then got off the phone with my sister. This is fight week. Like, I'm about to fight. So I'm cutting weight. I'm 115 pounds at this point. I'm normally 130. I get those calls. I fly to my dad's funeral that weekend. Fly down to final castings. Final castings is very excruciating. It's like you interview again and again. It's like on the spot, ready, set, go. Convince them. You're on the show, you know? All the castings, we stay there for a whole week. That's fight week. I go through castings with a smile. Fly from casting in LA to Buffalo, New York to weigh in. Literally the day of weigh-ins.
And you're fighting at 105?
And I was cutting weight the whole time at castings. And we did psych tests for 2 hours. We did IQ tests for 3 hours. Waiting and waiting and waiting. And we don't get to go to the gym because they don't want to see the fans to see like what's up. So I'm in the room jump roping for hours, cutting 8 pounds fight week. I fly to my weigh-ins. I make weight. I rehydrate. I fight. I win. I break down. Finally, I'm like, oh, I break down. I go home, and a week later, I get a call. I'm on Survivor. Like, pack your bags. I was like, they needed somebody. I don't know what the brilliant casting of Lynn Spillman. Don't know why she called me very last minute, but it was last minute. So she also didn't have time to fill me in. So I show up in LA. I have one little carry-on. Everybody has like 5 pull-away bags. This is behind the scenes, but most fans already know this, like real diehard fans. You start with like pregame, which is 3 days of not speaking to each other, but being in the same space. So it starts this like crazy, twisted eyeing of each other, like breaking each other down. Like, it was crazy. I think that because it's such a social experiment, and this show is real from top to bottom, right? I think they're just trying to drive us insane. Not insane, but like paranoia. We stayed in a whole resort together. Not a resort, it's like Tent City, it's not that nice. But we stayed somewhere together, like spent days together not speaking to each other. And there are people watching us, producers, where you're not allowed to talk to each other. Everybody has like books and like crossword puzzles and they have like things to do. And I'm sitting there barehanded like, what the hell, Lynn? I was like, this is psycho. Like, everybody's staring. This is psycho. So I just put on my little tough face, you know, whatever. I don't know what's going on, dude. And then we go. They put us on. They're finally, okay, finally you get to go. Okay, so they put us on this boat, drive us around circles for filming. They put us on this big barge. And then, oh, finally we get to talk to each other. And then... I didn't respect the game because I didn't watch it like that. I didn't know they were like crazy obsessive super fans, right? I'm just thinking like, oh, I'm savvy enough and people like me enough and I've been on my own. Like, I know how to fend for myself. And also, I was just saying yes because Dad just died and I'm just like, I'm here for it, you know? The whole thing was freaking crazy. And then these people start like dissecting the game and I'm sitting at camp like, what in the hell? It was a blessing in disguise. I'm surrounded by a bunch of super fans, but I have the ignorance is bliss right now, almost. One, they underestimate the hell out of me, but I'm still a smart chick. And two, they're driving themselves in circles of paranoia, you know? I was doing really well. I think socially I was doing really well. I may have not had strategically what they've seen before, but I was fine. Like, I was going to make the merge. But I hurt myself, and I'm wrapped up. I'm limping in excruciating pain because we're sleeping on bamboo. Also, I don't know the ins and outs of the games. I didn't know, like, you could sit out challenges. I didn't know all that, you know. So I had to make the decision to leave. And then back to the luggage thing. We leave. I didn't know that when you leave early, you go on a trip. So I'm on a trip. It's called the pre-merge trip. They take half of us away, right? Because you can't go home. People would know. So we go on a trip. I have no clothes. I have, like, nothing. And they're like, B, why didn't you pack anything? I'm borrowing Jessica's clothes, right? My mate from the island. And she's like, why didn't you pack anything? I'm like, oh, because we're supposed to be on an island. Like, with underwear and a bra. That's what I've been seeing on the show. They're just like, you idiot.
Where was the trip?
It was to Australia.
Following her season of Survivor, B came back to the States and began training for a fight with Jamie Hinshaw, an opponent she'd beaten a year and a half earlier. The fight took place in July of 2018 and ended in a loss, the third of B's career, and left her questioning whether or not she should continue fighting.
I just took a break. The break was amazing. I got really heavy, but I got really happy. I was contemplating after that loss, like, B, do you still have it in you? I've always wanted a family, so I was like contemplating, like, is this it? Like, let's just, should we focus on something else? And the more I took a break, I was like, oh, hell no. Like, I miss fighting. I'm not done, nowhere near done. I just had a little, like, I needed a little break, you know?
Around that time, B's management company landed her a lucrative deal with the incredibly successful fighting promotion 1FC in Asia. And just like that, she was back in the gym, prepping for her next fight. And she couldn't have been happier about it.
What do you want out of life moving forward?
I want... this is crazy. I want to be exactly where I am for longer. I don't have a financial goal. I have goals for myself, small goals. Like, I need to do this. I need to win this fight. I take one step at a time. But I've stopped looking to something so much because I want to enjoy it a lot more, the process of life, you know? Before, when I turned pro, I was like, I'm going to do this, make it to the UFC. And when it didn't happen, I thought it was the end of the world. And it's really not. I'm really happy right now working towards being the best fighter I can be, working towards changing more lives. I want to do more humanitarian work. My goal as a person, I want to encourage young girls around the world to go towards sports and to be empowered physically, because in third world countries like Vietnam, they're not encouraged to do sports. In India, they just started driving. In Jamaica, they're not encouraged to do sports. I volunteer in Jamaica with a sports program. I'm working with a company called the Karuna Project to open gyms in orphanages in Vietnam. So they have a place to do recreational, you know, activities, girls and guys. So that is my social goal. My fighting goal is just to be the best fighter I can be and keep putting on shows and getting paid to do what I do best. That's it. And just continue to better myself as a person. I think it's much simpler that way. If I say that my goal end of this year is to get this belt and it doesn't happen, I don't want to put that much emotional value into one tangible object. I don't want to put my happiness in a belt. I don't want to put my happiness in $500,000, in $1 million, you know? I'm going to put my happiness in progress because I know that's going to happen. So I will continue to be happy. But I've gotten really passionate about encouraging young girls because I forgot we were not allowed to do sports. And I was always a tomboy and shunned for it. I mean, I was put in ballet, which is great, but I would have liked soccer or basketball or martial arts. If that guy would have tried to abuse me now, I'd choke his ass out, right? So I want to encourage girls to try martial arts and be empowered and all that so they wouldn't put themselves in predicaments that a lot of us have been put in. All the things that happened to me wouldn't fly now. And so that's why I'm trying to encourage women.
So I want to give you a chance to do that. Last question for you. Yeah. So I'm confident there will be women, unfortunately, who hear this who are in similar situations.
Yeah.
What would you say to them?
I would say...
And you can speak directly to them, I think.
I think for women out there who... There's so many things I want to say to you. I want to talk to you every day. But there's a few things I want to say. That it happens to everyone. That you're not alone. Because domestic abuse, any kind of abuse, mental, emotional, physical... is not bias. It happens to everybody of every class. Corporate women, Asian women, black women, white women, young women, older women, everybody, anybody. So don't feel embarrassed, because if you look at the stats, you're definitely not alone. Unfortunately, we are in the majority. Also, I want to say that it's not normal. It's not okay. It's tough for me whenever I get asked this question, because this is why I want to work towards empowering from the outside in. Because now I'm just speaking to you in a situation. I'm going to tell you why this is a difficult thing for me to do, to just speak to her. Because it's hard to receive from her. Like, it's hard to tell her things and her hear it in a way that I want her to. We need to heal it from the outside in, which means we need to link hands together and all touch her together. You know what I mean? So I speak to the rest of the women who've gotten out, or even women who haven't been in it, to use their power to just open communication to her. The only thing I can tell her is that she's not alone, and to start talking every day, every day. Each conversation you have is gonna feed your soul and feed your courage, you know, to reach out. There's like millions and millions of hands out here. All you gotta do is reach, you know what I mean? But I encourage more so for us to reach in. It's harder to tell her to reach out. She is already brave enough to be surviving every single day. I don't guilt her for not reaching out. I don't judge her for not reaching out. It's fucking hard to be in there. It's dark. You can't see shit. Well, who are you reaching out to? Who I want to encourage is all the millions of hands to reach in. It's too much pressure when you're there. I hate the question of why didn't you speak up. I hate that question. Speak to who? You know? Why didn't she go to the cops? What cops? The cops that... stopped her from getting beat last night? No, they weren't there. The cops that stopped her from almost getting shot the day before? No, they weren't there. They're not there. Not that they're not there. She doesn't see them. So to reach out to who? Report to who? So we need to reach in. We need to tell her we're there. Cops that see odd things happening, they need to go up, in my humble opinion, and be like, is everything okay? We need to walk the streets and see a girl get dragged by her arm. Hey, is everything okay? Wake her up by saying, I'm here. Even if he says it's fine and they walk off and they're like, mind your fucking business, and they go home and same thing happens, she saw you for that split second. She saw that little hand. So make those hands visible. Start not minding our business. Start meddling, because these are our neighbors, you know? I do that all the time. People get annoyed at me. You know, people are like arguing. I'm like, everything okay? She's like, yeah, he's just an idiot. I'm like, okay, cool. I'm just checking to make sure you're good. You see my hand? That's all. That's all I think we all need to do.
All
I find myself so often wishing the world was different than it is. That we were farther along in our great social evolution. That human beings, all human beings, were treated as though they possessed the same inherent value as all others. That the centuries-old systems that have concentrated and protected wealth and power and privilege, while discounting the humanity of the masses based on their race, religion, sexual orientation, gender identity, age, education, socioeconomic status, or any of the other arbitrary categories with which we define one another, would be torn down in favor of a new human ethic that includes and affirms the basic goodness of all and binds us to one another. When I sat down with B, I saw a professional athlete, a reality TV star with a great laugh and a good story to tell. But by the time we finished talking, I realized I was looking at a human being, the type of human being who's fighting with the same grit and determination that got her where she is to create the very world I just described. Thanks so much to B for reminding me to open my eyes, to pay attention, to look outside myself, and to do more than just wish for the world to be different, to fight for it. If you are experiencing abuse of any sort and don't know where to turn, again, please check the show notes for this episode for a list of resources that may be able to help. If you want to keep up with everything B's got going, you'll also find links to her various social media channels in the show notes. You can also follow The H on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at The H Podcast, and me at Luke Bronner. Thanks so much for listening, friends. We'll be back in 2 weeks with Season 3, Episode 7. This episode was produced, edited, and mixed by me, Luke Bronner. Our artwork is by the amazing folks at Field of Study. Check them out at fieldofstudy.design. Our theme song is by Robbie C., and other songs featured in this episode are by Houston-raised piano prodigy Cameron Pissera and instrumental artist Broer. This and every episode of The H is brought to you in part by Pink Cilantro, a social-first digital agency focused on marketing, branding, and all sorts of other great stuff. Check them out at pinkcilantro.com. And now, here's a scene from our next episode.
I never talked. My customers knew how much fun I had and what restaurant I went to, you know, how my kids are doing. But I never spoke of my own life. If somebody would ask me, well, what happened to your parent? Oh, I don't know. That was during the war. I would always come up with some kind of a stupid answer because I didn't have the nerve to tell them that I was waiting for them to come home.